Why don't we make a start, and we're all present in body. Okay, well, so thanks a lot, everyone, for coming to this particular manifestation of the Sociology Forum. My name is Des Fitzgerald. I'm a PhD student in the Sociology Department. I'd like to really particularly thank our two speakers for giving up their free time to come and speak to us tonight. And we also want to thank the Organizing Committee of the Sociology Forum, especially Claire Alexander, and also the Sociology Department for supporting this event and making it happen. I'm really delighted to have the honour of introducing our main speaker tonight. It's Professor Steve Fuller. And Steve has one of the best job titles in British sociology, actually. He's the August Comte Professor in Social Epistemology at the University of Warwick.
August Comte is a little...
Trained in philosophy and widely recognised now as a sociologist, Steve has he's ranged across fields and contributed to a wide series of debates in social theory, epistemology, and social studies of science, particularly. Apart from pioneering the field of social epistemology, he's perhaps best known to wider audiences for his contributions to the intelligent design debate, and also his discussions of the confrontations between Popper and Kuhn at LSE, and other debates like that. His recent work has focused on the phenomenon of transhumanism, culminating most recently in the publication of his Humanity 2.0, which is the subject of our talk tonight. Committed to public knowledge, Steve has recently been president of the sociology section of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and is currently a fellow of the UK Academy of Social Sciences. Tonight's respondent is Carrie Freese. Hopefully well known to many people in this room. Carrie's lecture in the sociology of the life sciences and biomedicine here in the sociology department at LSE. The position she took up after her research work at the Centre for Society and Genetics at UCLA, and after her doctoral work at the Department of Medical Sociology at UCSF, just sociology at UCSF. Carrie's current work focuses on the development and use of genetic technologies in assisted reproduction. And she's recently explored these themes, particularly through an engagement with use of animal models and zoological cloning. Her first book on this theme is under contract with New York University Press, will hopefully manifest itself next year, and that's Cloning Wildlife, Realizing Science and Nature in the Zoo. Okay, so that's probably all the introductions we need. The final thing maybe to note is that the way we set up this event is slightly stolen from the Social Studies of Science annual meeting, where they do this kind of author meets critic session where they show their esteem for people's books by kind of publicly trashing them. So that's not what we're going to do tonight, but that's kind of where this kind of thing comes from. So Steve is going to talk for about 40 minutes, present some of the main ideas of his book, and then Carrie's going to respond for maybe 15 minutes, and then we'll open to the floor for hopefully what will be 30 full minutes of discussion. I think that's everything. The final thing to note, in terms of audio, Steve is going to record his own portion of his talk, which is great, but if you do heckle him, bear in mind you will be recorded, so... That's
you
fine.
Just don't leave your name.
That's true. And please, we've made a decision not to otherwise record the Sociology Forum events, just to allow for free-flowing discussion, so please don't otherwise record, if you wouldn't mind. That's everything. Otherwise, we'll hand you over to Steve.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Des, and thanks for everyone who is responsible for inviting me to this. I mean, it's great to be able to talk about this topic at the LSE, since the LSE is kind of a very important place for the discussion of the future of humanity, and in particular, the first sociology chair in this country in 1907, if you look at the candidates who were involved, a very prominent aspect of it, which is part of what the Humanity 2.0 idea is about, was the eugenics agenda. Okay, I mean, people like Francis Galton were very much involved as candidates for the first chair of sociology at the LSE. In fact, there's a new book that's out that I've written a foreword to called The Lost Biological Roots of British Sociology. Okay, and it is about this first chair. And so there is a sense and if you think about what Fabian socialism was about, who were very much behind the establishment of the LSE as an institution, the idea was planning for the long-term future of humanity, and the long-term future meant experimentation at the genetic level with regard to the kind of people we actually would want to have live in the future. Okay, so in other words, eugenics was seen as very much as part of a sort of long-term research program in experimenting with different possible human beings for different possible worlds. And in that kind of vein, it's not surprising perhaps that one of the people who was also being floated as a candidate for this chair in sociology was H.G. Wells, the science fiction author, who talked about sociology as the science of utopias. And if you think about what sociology meant up to 1907, especially within the English-speaking world, whether you're talking about, you know, Herbert Spencer or John Stuart Mill or Karl Marx or Auguste Comte or any of these people who might have been associated with sociology. All of these people are, in many in most respects, kind of, you know, they're drawing on knowledge of the past, they're drawing on history, they're drawing on empirical research of the present, but largely have a future orientation, and what we would call nowadays a policy orientation, perhaps. And sociology was originally seen very much in that ambit, but for a lot of reasons that have to do with the internal politics of the University of London, which already had a kind of chair in eugenics, essentially, at the University College London, the chair went to Leonard Hobhouse. Okay, and that set a kind of precedent for marginalizing eugenics and generally speaking, biological issues from the development of sociology in this country. Now, this country was not unique in that regard for various reasons, somewhat different reasons depending on what country one's talking about. Biology was also marginalized from the development of sociology, let's say, in France and Germany and the United States as well, even though it was always very much, you know, you might say, on the horizon in the establishment of the discipline. Okay. Now, it seems to me we're now in a period where, partly because there has been this kind of loss of strong disciplinary identity, and one can talk about various reasons for that, that the boundaries that separate the social and the biological sciences are much more porous, and indeed are about as porous as they were 100, 125 years ago when all of these discussions were first happening. And so in that respect, one of the values of looking at history, including the founding of the first chair of sociology here, is a lot of the issues are kind of, in a way, the same in a new key. Okay? And I think one of the obvious ways in which you see this is the enormous amount of influence, certainly over the last 25 years, that things like sociobiology and evolutionary psychology have had, certainly in the public imagination, in terms of providing explanatory frameworks for understanding the nature of social life, and for a greater kind of acceptance of the idea that the difference between human beings, human societies, let's say, and animal societies are a matter of degree rather than kind. Right, and so that the whole idea of having to have a sort of self-contained science of the social that is intrinsically human and exclusively human, that the intuition behind that is not as salient as it was 100 years ago when classical sociology was supreme. And so there are all of these kinds of issues, in a sense, where we need now to renegotiate about what it is that makes us human under these circumstances. Because certainly having a society isn't going to cut it as an adequate answer. And so Humanity 2.0, in a way, is kind of, you might say, the name of this kind of crossroads we're in, where we're forced to sort of redefine what it is to be a human being and whether there's anything, as it were, distinctive, essential, or whatever, that marks us off from other sorts of beings. Now, the point that I make in this book, Humanity 2.0, which came out in the autumn of last year, is that in a sense this problem has always been with us, and it very much is tied to essentially this kind of dualistic understanding that we have as human beings. On the one hand, there's always been this understanding that human beings are animals of a certain sort. That really has not been denied. But there's also, and this is where what supposedly is distinctively human, somehow this is an animal that tries to transcend its animal origins. Okay, so this business of self-transcendence is a very important part as well. And where this kind of idea has sort of played itself out in the most intellectually interesting and significant and politically significant fashion has been through theology, especially in the monotheistic traditions. And it's not by accident that when somebody like Auguste Comte wants to inaugurate a science of sociology which would be dedicated to the project of humanity, a vehicle by which we would organize knowledge in such a way that we could fully realize what human potential is at a collective level, that in a sense he kind of draws on the framework of theology but infuses it with a sort of scientific mentality. And that is kind of the way the story goes historically, that there is this kind of transfer through the process of secularization and the Enlightenment of basically a kind of theological understanding of the distinctness of human beings as somehow this kind of complex of animal and something that transcends the animal, call it spiritual, mental, consciousness, meaningfulness, whatever, and the sort of scientific version of that that you start to get in the 19th century and is captured by, the human sciences. And this is the kind of project that Foucault famously deconstructed in The Order of Things, right? That there's a sense in which you get this transition from a sort of theological understanding of the distinctiveness of the human as this animal created in the image and likeness of God. And then in the 19th century, this gets secularized, but you still have the distinctiveness of the human in a body of knowledge, systematic body of knowledge, the human sciences, which instead of talking about the spirit, talks about consciousness and meaning, right? And so those words, as it were, just pretty much pick up the conversation from theology and provide a secular version of it. And hermeneutics, in a way, is kind of the easiest way to sort of see that transition. But of course, it happens throughout all the other fields as well. And theologians have been quite aware of this as well, usually quite critically of what the social sciences have done to the theological horizon on what the human is. And John Milbank, I don't know if this name means anything to this audience, but John Milbank, who is a neo-Orthodox Anglican theologian who's now at the University of Nottingham, wrote a very interesting book where in a sense, he talks about the development of the social sciences out of theology as a kind of corruption of theology. Okay, a secular corruption of theology. Now, of course, people typically don't take this kind of stuff seriously, especially if they're on the social science side of this argument. But as the 19th century wore on, and this is part of the point that Foucault is making, and certainly as the 20th century developed, the whole idea of trying to specify something that separates humans from animals that warrants a distinctive body of knowledge called the human sciences starts to come under attack in many ways, and largely through issues having to do with what we might call the unconscious, the way in which things that human beings do happen behind the backs of what they are supposedly in control of. And so not only Marx with ideas of false consciousness, because Marx in a sense believes we can be redeemed in the end in a sense, but Sigmund Freud, of course Nietzsche, right, all of these people who play into what we now call the postmodern condition, gradually deconstruct the significance of what it is to be distinctively human. Now, meanwhile, while that is happening, and of course you get the development of biological sciences, and you get a more sophisticated understanding of how animals work, and of course we understand genetics. And so a lot of the seemingly qualitative differences between ourselves and animals start to disappear at a scientific level through the biological sciences over the course of the 20th century. So now we quite easily admit there's this enormous 95% genetic overlap with other animals. In terms of what animals are capable of doing, even issues like the distinctiveness of language is a human capacity, that in a way is under a lot of challenge because one can talk about, all animals have other kinds of communication systems, they're very complex, they're very sophisticated, they're very adequate to the environments in which they live. And there's a sense in which what we want to claim to be the distinctiveness of language might be just a kind of species chauvinism, in a sense, right? And that, in fact, animals are very sophisticated. And this has, of course, had normative effects downstream. And here I think about somebody like Peter Singer, for example. And Peter Singer is a very important figure in the book that I'm talking about because, in a sense, Singer really challenges the normative salience of human as an ethical, moral, political category. Okay, and so that is a really strong challenge, and it's a challenge that I would say over the course of my academic career, over 25 years, has been taken with an increasing seriousness, because when it all began, so back in the 70s and 80s, it was seen as a bit of a crank thing, animal rights and all that, right? But nowadays, I think it's a very serious thing, and there are a lot of people who are very much on board with this, and so there's a kind of open question with regard to where does the normative salience of the human come from? But this is not just about an issue about the way in which the biological sciences have gradually eroded the criteria by which we distinguish human beings. There's a kind of an assault coming on the other side, and that has to do with the issues surrounding, let's say, computer technology and information technology. I mean, the Economist magazine the Economist magazine does these periodic online debates. And one of the debates that it did in October 2010 was what was the most significant innovation of the 20th century? And the answer, 3-to-1 margin, computer, the computer. And the interesting thing about the computer, of course, is it's not just the computer as a tool that facilitates various things, but more importantly, the computer as part of the environment of the human life world, a very integral part of the human of the human life world, and moreover, perhaps even a model or an exemplar of a certain kind of being a human can become. Okay, and here one thinks about the significance of the amount of time that people spend in front of computer screens, not just trying to do things, but in a sense living their lives there, right? I mean, so we talk about the second self, the second life phenomena, but there are other things as well, where in a sense the meaningfulness of people's interactions are transpiring through computer technology, and people are being judged by those kinds of standards. Even to the abandonment of one's biological bodies of birth. So people are now concerned about the long-term health implications of spending all this time in front of a screen. People aren't moving around enough. Obesity is on the rise. Heart disease, blah, blah, blah. Whatever one wants to make of those kinds of concerns, I think one of the things that you could sort of see is, you know, if you're asking a question, you know, what is it that people are identifying with as meaningful in their lives, right? There is a large percentage of people that are gravitating to the information technology as giving them a kind of meaning, more meaning than perhaps dealing with other organic creatures. Okay, so the business of people becoming, you know, people migrating into cyberspace, becoming avatars, or in the more extreme case, the sort of utopias of somebody like Ray Kurzweil about the singularity, where you sort of upload your consciousness and you're in there in perpetuity in some kind of silicon existence. People find this attractive, regardless of whether it's possible. The interesting thing is people are find it attractive. People are willing to invest in it, not only time but money. And so there is a sense in which, if you want to say where is the future of humanity going, there's a large percentage of that that's going in that direction, right? And I do think that one always has to look at, you know, people voting with their feet on these matters. Where are people spending their time? How are they spending their time? Where are they getting the most sense of fulfillment and so forth in their lives? And so from that standpoint, you have this kind of opposite movement, which is a movement very much away from a closer identification with biological bodies at birth, you know, where one can easily imagine human beings engaged in sympathy, in, you know, sympathetic understanding with animals, but moving into this other space where our carbon origins become seen as a kind of drawback, as something that's holding us back from being able to participate in this other form of existence that information technology allows. Okay, and so now, the interesting thing about the whole information technology move is the fact that people are inclined to speak about it in spiritualist terms. For me, that's a very important part of this. You know, in other words, I really do see people like Kurzweil as, in a way, reinventing in a secular guise the spiritualist aspect of what it is that distinguishes human beings from other creatures. And I'm willing to take the theological dimension of that quite seriously. And so, you know, there was a book that came out when Kurzweil's first book in this vein was called The Age of Spiritual Machines. Some of you may remember that came out about 10 years ago. And around that time, there was this book that came out by Eric Davis called Technosis, right? Where the gnosis refers to Gnosticism, which is this kind of dissenting a strand in early Christianity, which was basically believed that the human body itself was intrinsically evil, and that the goal of human life would be to somehow get yourself out of it, right? To release your spirit, right? And this is where the information technology would come in as being kind of the vehicle by which you might be able to do that in the 21st century, right? So this is the technosis. So this kind of mentality actually has a very strong theological dimension, typically quite a dissenting, heretical sort of dimension, but very recognizable, it seems to me, and a lot of the arguments that are being made now are of that kind. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at these, so if you think about these two sorts of extremes that I've been putting forward, as alternative visions of humanity 2.0. On the one hand, you have this idea that human beings are really more and more like other animals, right? A kind of a view that very much comports well with animal rights and also with a kind of ecological perspective. That's one side. But then on the other side, you have this other view whereby, in fact, the animal part of us is holding us back from our being these kind of all-conscious, all-rational, whatever, all-thinking creatures, which require a more durable kind of medium for that to be pulled off, right? Those are two quite extreme visions of what humanity 2.0 might be. So from that standpoint, then the middle position would be something like people who are interested in extending human life in its current form. So some of you may know about Aubrey de Grey. Have you heard of this guy? I mean, Mr. Methuselah?
Sense.
What?
Sense.
Yeah. So Aubrey de Grey is basically a guy who believes that we are that all you have to do is do a few switches to genes, and you can unleash our potential to live up to 1,000 years. Okay? I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen overnight, but the point is this is an interesting thing. The interesting thing about this is not whether it's likely to happen, but the fact that this is being put forward as an ideal, right? And that there is a certain kind of constituency for this, right? People who think there's something intrinsically good about living as long as possible, and as it were, continuing whatever one does when one's an adult only indefinitely, okay? And this, in a way, is meant to combine, you might say, the two extreme visions. Because on the one hand, it has this sort of extended longevity thing that people like Kurzweil are very keen about. But it doesn't require that you actually abandon your carbon-based body, right? What you do, rather, is you kind of, you know, modify it. So you take the carbon-based, you know, so, and this is where messing around with the genes becomes kind of useful. And so I take that to be a kind of middle position in this argument, actually. This idea of wanting, because what, you know, Aubrey de Grey is promising is, in a sense, you can kind of live the life you live, but you'll live it forever in a healthy form. Okay, and that's another vision that's on the table as well. And again, the interesting thing about all of these visions is there's money attracted to people. There are constituencies for these things. Now, the question becomes, well, where is social science in this? Right? Where is social science in terms of these kinds of utopias, right? In terms of these kinds of visions? And it is, I think, a very sort of tricky position for social scientists to kind of argue. I mean, because on the one hand, you might say, well, social scientists can study this stuff, right? That's kind of the easy answer, right? We do ethnographies of everything, right? So the more of this stuff that happens, the better. We've got jobs. We've got postdocs, right? I mean, that's the easy answer. I think that's, you know, that's the sort of the, you know, kind of the no-brainer answer to this, right? We just study this stuff. We follow these guys around, how they get their money, what happens, the politics of it, and of course it all fails in the end, right? I think that's maybe the default position, I think, for the social scientist. And you know, that's fine, you know, if the social scientist just sees themselves as a sort of jobber, right? Someone who is up there for hire, whatever happens to be the social phenomenon of the moment, you know, we're there to study in a very close detail, follow the networks, whatever. The problem is, what's the point of that enterprise from anything that might resemble a larger intellectual or disciplinary project? Right? What is the point of doing social science under those circumstances? Right? Because in the beginning, right, the whole point of doing empirical research, right, was to understand society for some purpose of social transformation or social consolidation, right, or social maintenance of social order. I mean, Durkheim, in a way, is very explicit about this, right, that there's a sense in which the point of doing empirical social science research was in the aid of a certain kind of vision of society. Okay. And in fact, one of the interesting things about the 19th century people who one might have thought of as sociologists before the discipline gets established, but where the word was thrown around as kind of an ideological word, is that all these people, whether we're talking about Spencer or Mill or Marx, right, Comte, in a sense, you know, they thought it was important to do empirical research, but in a sense, to be able to inform some kind of social transformation. In other words, to have a kind of rational politics of some sort. And it was in aid of that that one did empirical research. I don't think any of these people actually believed empirical research was an end in itself. Okay? I mean, so I do think but once you actually drop out some kind of sense of a social idea, of a social utopia, right? Just go back to H.G. Wells, Sociology of the Science of Utopias. How could he have said such a thing? Well, actually, if you look at the 19th century, it's pretty easy to see that. Because empirical research was not being done as an end in itself. Okay? Of course, once you get academic disciplines that have research programs which lay out problems, then of course you can talk about, in the kind of Kuhnian sense, you might say, that you have the kind of puzzle solving. There are certain kinds of bits of research that need to be done to test certain hypotheses within certain kinds of theories that various schools are promoting. That's understandable too. But the problem now that we face in the beginning of the 21st century is that those kinds of disciplinary boundaries within which paradigms existed are being exploded. Okay, and in fact, what we now tend to do is we tend to train people in social research methods. We don't tend to train them in any kind of theoretical horizon, at least no kind of unified one. And then people just go out and find interesting things to study. And so in a sense, we sort of give up the game with regard to how to define what it is to be human, what it is to be social. And what we just do is we follow the more dominant players who are actually making those definitions. And those definitions, of course, are being made by the funders, whoever they happen to be, public and private. But also, there are certain academic disciplines, like within the biological sciences, that actually do have some strong, where they have people with some strong views that do promote them. I'm going to be reviewing for the Literary Review new book, some of you may have seen it, by Mark Pagel, who is a professor of evolutionary psychology at the University of Reading, called Wired for Culture. Okay? And this book, I believe it was in Nature, was reviewed last week as saying this is the most important book, something written about social science, you know, in eons. In Nature, I think this was in Nature, this was said, okay? Now, the fact that this sort of statement can be made in such a bald-faced, unembarrassed kind of way shows that we've got our work cut out if we're trying to actually defend some notion of social science that is the science of the human in some recognizable sense that just doesn't blur into somebody else's agenda, where they have more control over it. Okay? So I do think there's a real challenge here. It's not just a challenge of what it is to be a human being from the standpoint of one's own personal self-development or whatever policy making we have. I mean, because of course, right, there's all that stuff. But it also seems to me from an academic standpoint, insofar as we want to be promoting a body of knowledge called social science, we need to regain control of this kind of discussion of what it is to be human. Okay, and Humanity 2.0 in a way is kind of a marker for that, because the sort of traditional notions of humanity, I mean, so for example, if you look at issues having to do with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which is often seen as kind of a benchmark for Humanity 1.0, right, where we talk about the individual, the integrity of the individual person and body and free expression and all this kind of thing. If you actually go through that statement of the UN Declaration of Human Rights and you actually give it the kind, you know, you can deconstruct all that stuff and say, well, look, do people really believe this? Is this really enforced? Is this really what it is to be human? And all, before you know it, it all dissolves. Okay? It all dissolves. And so then the question becomes, okay, does that mean the human dissolved? Is there nothing at stake here? I'm not going to take up too much more time. I think I'll stop after this so we have a little more time for discussion. One of the things that when I teach at the undergraduate level, I teach the sociology of knowledge, and so I do talk about this kind of thing in the context of the sort of larger kind of horizon of Western intellectual history. And trying to explain to undergraduates sometimes about why everybody was so caught up with the idea of progress, you know, at least until I was a student, then it all sort of declined after postmodernism. But there was this great fascination for progress from the Enlightenment until, let's say, the mid-20th century. And that word was meant to be a kind of marker for the direction by which humanity came to self-realization, where as it were, its distinctiveness from other things in the world, from other creatures in the world, finally was realized. And it was always associated with, I'm not going to deny it, with a kind of godlike position for human beings, where we take control of the world, we can control everything, we can do things kind of in the way in which we collectively agreed to do, right? And there was a very clear vision that there was something, you know, to be a human, and that we can chart our way toward that, and we can talk about, you know, certain things that advance and certain things that bring it back from that kind of general trajectory. But that intuition disappeared. At least it's disappeared as anything people are willing to defend in public. And so one of the consequences of that, I think, is in the process, the idea of being human has disappeared. Because the idea of being human has always been a matter of a journey, of some kind of project. Whether we're talking about Comte or Marx or any of these people who have been sort of championing the idea of humanity, it was always about going from where we are now to some other place. And now people just think, well, there is no other particular place to go to. People will go to different places, we'll study them, we'll see how things work out. But there is no overarching project into which we all feed. So, for example, one can easily imagine in the future, we may have, as it were, partially overlapping ecologies where humans and animals coexist, and each of, you know, and you have different sorts of rules and regulations governing them. In some societies, perhaps, humans are the top dogs, as it were, but in other societies, there may be a much more egalitarian view with regard to humans and animals, and all of these different life worlds may coexist in some way in the future. And this might, you know, I mean, and in that respect, then, you know, the idea of the human as being a kind of overriding normative goal or value disappears under those circumstances. And of course, I think that's a kind of a, that's a possible future. And a future I think some people would quite happily endorse now. Okay? And on the other side, we might want to think about the increasing use of, the increasing construction and use of androids as companions. This is especially true with the elderly. But my guess is that over time, right, there is going to be this other kind of ecology developing where humans and machines, right, are in fact regarded as partnered, engaging in social interaction, where one has to talk about reciprocal rights and obligations between humans and machines, right, that kind of environment may exist as well. And we may be heading ourselves into a kind of patchwork world where humans are relating to many different non-human things through a whole complex of legislation and rules and things of that sort. Now, I think when that happens, then the whole idea of there being a project of humanity will have disappeared, right? Where humans are just considered one among many creatures. And there's a sense in which if you want to understand what is the science by which you would understand this patchwork of social relations that cross species boundaries and even material boundaries, right? You wouldn't have to call it sociology or social science, or if it's, you know, you could call it asociology, it's like a lot of the network theories like to talk about it, right? You give it some kind of content-neutral name, right? Where in a sense, being human isn't really essential to what the thing's about, but rather what one's focused on is the nature of the associations that are involved, right? We may be moving in that direction. And people, and you know, I see some nods of heads here. Some people seem to like this possibility. But I do think this is going to be something that whatever one thinks, one shouldn't just be, as it were, sliding into it from, you know, from the back. This is something I think that actually deserves some very serious political discussion, actually, some serious public discussion, because it does end up bearing significantly on how we allocate our resources, what value do we give to somebody simply by virtue of being born a human being. Right, all of those kinds of issues, those boundary issues, you know, where humans are most vulnerable, actually are quite problematized under this kind of alternative world that I'm talking about here. And so it's not surprising, for example, that somebody like Peter Singer, right, who's not only a great animal rights activist and so forth, but also, you know, is, you know, has this kind of very strong view on abortion, on euthanasia, right, and that's not surprising under the circumstances, because he's interested in the capacity of beings to be able to live the fullest lives they can, regardless of what their genetic makeup is. And that's the benchmark, not whether they happen to be a human being, okay, by birth. You see, so there's a lot of serious policy and political implications here with regard to having what on the surface might seem to be a very kind of ontologically tolerant viewpoint, where you have these patchwork social worlds which are mixed with humans and non-humans. There's a lot. It actually, in practice, would be quite severe, actually. And the problem is, at the moment, we're just talking about this, you know, as intellectual abstractions and so forth. But in fact, these are issues of serious political import once you imagine what they would be like in practice when they get beyond the level of just being a theoretical framework for analyzing data. And in a sense, Humanity 2.0 kind of puts this on the table. And I think that, you know, in the future, it's going to be unavoidable. And, you know, those of us who are on top of these kinds of discussions, I do think have a kind of a responsibility to begin to bring this into the public forum and to begin to kind of tease out the normative implications and what these new worlds would look like that would be mixing humans and non-humans in the way it's been suggested. And if there are people who want to defend a very strong, classically humanist view of the world, a human-dominant view of the world, then those people need to come out of the closet as well, too. And I will stop at that point just so we have some time for discussion. Thank you for listening.